More recently, I've heard, you know, closer to 10.
10,000 fakes. It's a volume business.
Yeah.
There's a meta aspect of this because the cops come knocking on your door for your files.
Yes. As happy as I was with the work they were doing, and they all slapped me on the back at the announcement and thanked me and said that the film had been a roadmap for their investigation.
Kastner gets action.
They then said, now please turn over all the raw material of your film. And I felt torn. On one hand, I was very happy with where the work had led. On the other hand, as we all know as journalists, there needs to be a separation between journalists and the police.
Yeah.
We can't function. No one will talk to us. And it's not part of our contract of trust with our subjects that we are going to just hand over our material willy-nilly to the cops. So I had to fight this out of my own pocket. I was supported at least by folks like the Canadian Association of Journalists. I mean, supported morally, and they sent a lawyer to intervene. But unfortunately, I didn't win.
You had to hand it over under threat of criminal consequences for you.
Yeah, basically, I fought it as far as I could and, you know, at no small expense. Strictly on principle, I'll add, because I know that the good stuff was already in the film.
Not just that, but, you know, there are cases where the cops want a journalist's files and the outcome might be that they're going to actually arrest your source. In this case, if they made arrests, the right people would be getting arrested. If they got convictions, it's like the criminals are getting convicted. Your film was successful in bringing people to justice. It's a great validation of your work. For those convictions, like, you know, it's a confluence of interest, not a conflict of interest, except for the fact that you have principles.
Well, unfortunately, that's it. We have to continue to function as journalists.
Yeah.
And although in this case, our interests were aligned, in reality, I cannot just turn over my footage to cops for the asking. It's as simple as that. Even if I agree with what they're doing, it was a tricky situation. But I mean, journalists generally understand.
Ryan, I'm not sure if you've been in touch with any of your sources in Thunder Bay about like just sort of the aftermath, the fallout of this whole episode. Is there anything you can tell us?
I think that there are a good number of people that have been collateral damage in this story, right? There are people working really hard at asking the questions of like, you know, what is the legacy now? How do we move forward knowing that the scale and scope of this thing is such that it is? And I don't know that there are any really good answers, but there are still a lot of concerns out there, like the ongoing process of authenticating works. I think there's a wide open question that the art world needs to answer, and they are reluctant to answer. And that is, you know, what about your painting? And I know that there are a lot of cultural institutions, galleries, universities, and places that, you know, when you're building a new wing to your fancy building, you borrow against your assets. And a lot of these assets are deep collections of rare and beautiful artworks. And I know because of sources that have told me that there are institutions that are reluctant to have their works authenticated by outside parties. And that troubles me because if the works aren't authenticated by outside parties, how do we know that they are true, that they are real, that they were painted by Norvell? And the answers is like, well, the institutions say, well, we have experts. Well, your experts weren't a part of bringing down a very dangerous art fraud ring, and your experts weren't the ones that were at the heart of this story behind the scenes, putting their lives on the line when a 6'5" biker who is rumored to have killed someone and is a pedophile is out there making threats to people. And so for an institution or a gallery to say like, no, we're good, we have experts in-house, I have a problem with that.
You're suggesting we need to have like third-party independent confirmation.
I'm suggesting that if Norvell Morso's legacy matters to anyone, that we ought to be asking the really hard question of what comes next. And to me, authenticating those works and getting those fakes out of the market so as to protect the market and to protect the name of Norvell Morso, it should be front and center. And I have a real problem with institutions and galleries and private collections that refuse to do that because there is too much at stake. I have questions for the Morso estate.
It's implied in Jamie's film that Morso's brother Wolf might have had something to do with this, and Benji Morso, Norvell Morso's nephew, will be sentenced in October for his involvement. Ryan, there's one more institution to add to that list that has not really, to any degree of legitimacy, tried to authenticate their Norvell Morso. My mom and dad have a print hanging over the couch. And
this goes deeper than I thought.
Yeah.
I was wondering what form the sequel would take.
I think you know your target, and I'm honor bound to throw them under the bus. It's a beautiful, beautiful print. What we don't know doesn't hurt us, right?
The other problem now is that the internet has got a hold of this, and the works that are being printed in Germany and China and other places on websites like Temu and others. I mean, you can go onto eBay right now and find yourself a Norvel Morso. You can go on Kijiji any given day and find them. Facebook Marketplace is flooded with these things, and new ones pop up all the time. And, tracking them is very, very difficult. And so the fact that China and Germany are onto this, are mass producing these works, I mean, this story is far from over.
Jamie, what was the outcome with Gary Lamont?
Gary Lamont, who is considered the ringleader of one of the prime fraud rings, was sentenced in December to 5 years.
For the forgeries?
For the forgeries, for his role in the forgeries.
I see that a week before Lamont's sentencing for the forgeries, he pled guilty to sexual assault charges.
Yes, not for the first time.
Jamie Kastner, Ryan McMahon, it was fascinating. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
That is your Canada Land. I hope you enjoyed it. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com with feedback on what you hear on our podcasts. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Tristan Capicchione. Max Collins is our production manager. Our theme music is by So Called. Fact-checking by Kevin O'Keefe. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. I'm Jesse Brown, and today we are talking shit about the news. I'll be talking with Norman Spector about rebel media. Ezra Levant has been denied membership into the club he said he would never, ever, ever join. The Club of Qualified Journalists. We'll also touch on why diss tracks probably should not be entered into evidence in murder trials. And do you remember this parenting advice from BC Conservative leader John Rustad?
We should not be expecting our kids to eat bugs.
I mean, not until they finish their supper first. Anyhow, Rustad also wants you to know that he regrets how much he had to drink last night.
I've had 3 shots of the vaccine. I wish I hadn't, quite frankly.
Wait for that. Once again, we have Canada's former chief of staff to then Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, also Canada's former ambassador to Israel, Canada's first representative to the Palestinian Authority, former publisher of the Jerusalem Post, former Globe and Mail columnist, and current podcast guest, Norman Spector. Welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
Norman, God help me, I want to talk about Ezra Levant and rebel media today. More widely, I want to talk about this ongoing national experiment that the Trudeau government has taken with the press. In very different ways, Ezra Levant over at The Rebel and me, myself, have been very critical of a bunch of different efforts for the government to get involved in media. But specifically, we've both been critical of the idea that the government would assess news organizations and decide whether or not they meet certain criteria. And the designation they came up with was a qualified Canadian journalism organization, QCJOs. My objection to this was just like on a level of principle, a fundamental level, that it's not the government's job to determine who is and who is not a journalist. I mean, that is a very difficult question for anyone to answer, for journalism experts to answer. Journalist as a profession, as opposed to the act of journalism, which is, I think, a basic human right. Journalism, does having an agenda or being an activist disqualify you? And what about analysis? It's just so complex. And I just think that it has to be something that gets worked out in the civil discourse. So that's my beef with it. And I thought that having the government in that role would diminish people's trust in journalists, that you have one category of journalists that's government designated and one that is not. Ezra Levant's objection from the start was that this was Justin Trudeau's attempt to purchase journalists, to buy a compliant press that would give him good press, to bribe the press with money. The reason why I'm refreshing everybody on this right now is that there's been a development. Rebel Media applied for this status and was rejected.
A dark day for Rebel News as the federal court rules against us.
Justin Trudeau's QCJO, Qualified Canadian Journalism Organization.
Trudeau has spent millions of dollars censoring us, including creating this well-paid censorship panel clearly built with Rebel News in mind.
Instead of journalists holding politicians to account, politicians are now holding journalists to account.
Only 2% of our stories were original news content? What does that even mean?
You have to apply to the CRA, the Canada Revenue Agency.
I've actually heard this law called the Get Rebel News Law, but it's in some ways a Get Rebel News Supporters Law as well.
So, Norman, Ezra, after having the Rebel rejected by the QCJO panel, and you listeners heard me interview the chair of that panel, Colette Brin, on the show some time ago.
We don't see ourselves as being the journalism police or the journalism popes or whatever. We're not determining what is journalism and what isn't journalism.
After they rejected the Rebel, he took it to court and the court threw it out. What do you make of all this? I mean, during your days as chief of staff for Mulroney, there was nothing like this. And I'm not sure if the timeline lines up, but there was once the Kent Commission when there actually was a government proposal to subsidize the media and get involved. And at that time, when newspapers were much stronger, the newspaper publisher said, get lost. We do not want your money. We don't want your designation. Government should stay out of the media. What do you make of how the Trudeau government has involved itself?
I share your misgivings. First of all, I wouldn't use the word profession for journalists. There's no professional accreditation or necessary degree or whatever.
It's a trade.
It's an occupation.
Yeah.
But it's also an occupation that sort of anybody can do.
But that's a feature, not a bug to me. That's good. Like,
that's exactly right.
You know? Try it at home.
It's almost like being a musician. These days, you can record in your bedroom and have a hit album.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've got talent and luck and all kinds of other things, but anybody can really do it with today's technology. You know, I have a degree in television radio as well, when things were very, very different in the 70s in terms of soundboards and videotape and all this sort of thing. But today it's all democratized. You can do a documentary on an iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
In high resolution, and you can record audio of high quality and all that. So anybody can really do it today. Secondly, I think this really hurts the media. I think it just feeds into conspiracy theories of people being able to say, well, don't trust them. They're government funded, or they're in the pocket of the government. And we had a case of that just the other day when CTV had to apologize on air.
I know that the media has worked hard to try and avoid me saying the words carbon tax, as we saw in the extremely dishonest and fraudulent report from Bell Media Controlled CTV, whose bonds have been downgraded to near junk status as its overpaid CEO empties the books to pay his wealthy friends an unacceptably and unrealistically high dividend.
Now, look. My view of that is never look for conspiracy and media bias where incompetence can explain something. Everybody makes mistakes, and there's lots of incompetence, particularly these days where people are short-staffed. You have a lot of young people entering with very little experience, almost coming in as interns. So I highly doubt it was intentional, as the conservatives are alleging, but it feeds into this sort of conspiracy. So I think journalists, however you define them, are vital elements of a democracy. And freedom of information laws are essential to the proper functioning of a democracy. But the last people I want funding the journalists who are holding the government accountable are the governments. So here's some ideas that I've had. Why not make subscriptions or donations to media organizations fully tax deductible.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least as tax deductible as donating to a political party. You know, you get a better tax deduction for donating to a political party than you do for cancer research. Now, why would that be? So that's number one. Number two, there's a successful model. We have a successful model of a newspaper that was saved, La Presse. How was it saved?
By turning to a philanthropic model.
Correct. It was given charitable status. First of all, the owners dumped it.
Yeah.
Because it was costing them money, and the separatist boogeyman had kind of disappeared. And Paul Desmarais didn't have to do any more favors to Jean Chrétien to keep it in business. So they established it as a charity. Le Devoir had to wait for years to get that same status. They have it now. But if you look at La Presse these days, with the tablet edition that failed at the Toronto Star a few years ago, they are hiring people.
Yeah.
They're sending people abroad to report on stories.
What you're saying is totally accurate. And the reason why this has not been the strategy that other newspapers in English Canada have followed is because the other newspapers in English Canada have spent decades degrading their relationship with their own subscribers and listeners, and they do not have the same level of passion and commitment and attachment that the Quebec readers of those papers have. You would not find enough people who would make charitable donations to the Toronto Star or to the Toronto Sun because those papers are not what they were, and people don't feel that way about them. I could kiss you for your point about the tax breaks. Like right now, we also applied for QCJO status, and like Ezra Levant, oh, just feels dirty saying it, I have something in common with Ezra Levant, which is we've both said we're not going to take government money, and as far as I know, he doesn't, and we certainly do not. Canada Land applied for and received QCJO status in part in order to qualify for the 15% tax subsidy, the tax break that we can give our supporters, not just yet, but once all the paperwork sometime in the future. And it's not going to matter, because if we say to people, support us now because in 8 months you'll get a 15% tax rebate, is not going to really help us. People won't remember that. If we could say every dollar you give us, you can deduct from your taxes, that would have a really dramatic impact.
Why not do that?
And then you know who's deciding who's the journalist that should get the subsidy? The newsreader. The newsreader
exactly
would be
right. The audience.
Yeah. So we can agree with each other very loudly here. That is exactly what they should do. But it's not what they did do. And what they did has had like demonstrable, measurable effects on people's trust in the press. It's not just you and me saying that it's going to crater people's trust. The trust has gone down since they've done this. And then every time there's a mistake, like CTV's mistake, which I agree with you, you know, the idea that in newsrooms they're sitting around deciding on who, you know, oh, let's do the bias against Polyev. No, like people just screw up. You know, sometimes they screw up based on unconscious bias, but a lot of the time they just screw up. But no, every time they screw up, Polyev takes another whack at us. And it's true. $30,000 of that reporter's salary was paid for by the Trudeau government. I mean, that is true. Whether that had anything to do with the mistake, I doubt very much.
But it's a really easy target.
So here's another one now that was so predictable. It was a hypothetical thing of like, oh, if the government's going to choose who's a QCJO and not, what's to stop them from giving that status to media that they like and denying it to media that criticize them? And who criticizes them more than rebel media? Norman, we've heard Ezra for years just deride this whole notion that there should be this government-appointed body determining who is a journalist and who isn't. And one thing that I'm really unclear about is like, okay, so why did you apply if that's the case? After the break, I want to share with you what I think the real reason is for why Ezra filed for QCJO status in the first place. Stay tuned. I think that one of the reasons why Ezra Levant, this is just my opinion, applied for this was in order to be rejected.
Absolutely.
So that he could raise money, which he's currently doing for the legal side. And, you know,
you're going to have to expurgate what I'm going to say right now, but Ezra's a bit of a disturber.
I think he would be happy with that designation. He sues for many things, and I should say now he's funding a lawsuit against Canada Land. I don't think he would mind that one. We'll leave that in. Look, he has turned a hypothetical fear into a practical one. They have now denied their biggest critic status, and he can now say it's because we criticize them. If you actually look at why they deny it, it's no better in a way. They're denying it on the basis that what they do is they take a look at like a snapshot of what you publish. They look at you over a certain period of time, or they just randomly select a bunch of articles, and then they put you up against this criteria. This is how they and they say we are. Even the QCJO board says we're not here like assessing whether this is good journalism or bad. This is objective. And their objective criteria is not objective because they're making subjective decisions about what is and isn't journalism on the basis of what is original reporting and what is analysis. And then they don't even say you have to have a certain amount of original reporting. It seems to be as a ratio. And they determined that the Rebels ratio. So it doesn't matter if you've got lots of original reporting. It's what is the ratio of original reporting to analysis. Now, I reject the idea that analysis is not journalism, right? Original reporting is the most important thing. You have to have reporters getting the facts. That is the bedrock. And you can't have good analysis if you don't have good reporting. But what we're doing now is, like, this will be fact-checked. This is helping people understand the news. How is this not journalism? We do original reporting and analysis. I don't know what our ratio is. I guess it was good enough for us to get accepted. But if there was a company that just does really good analysis, really top-level analysis, I guess they couldn't get QCJO status?
Well, I'll give you an example of that. I don't know if you noticed during the campaign against Biden and the handover to Harris, the New York Times, on its front page, the lead articles were often analysis.
That doesn't surprise me that the lead articles, and that's one of the big problems in news, is that it's way cheaper to publish analysis than reporting, and it performs better.
I think they were on a campaign against Biden.
Oh, there's no question.
Okay. They claim that they separate news and opinion, but they include analysis as news.
I saw you commenting on this, and I agreed with you, but I took a different takeaway than yours, because you seem to be criticizing the New York Times, who I think very much went on an editorial crusade to get Biden to step down.
Right.
I think that was absolutely, but so what? Newsrooms go on crusades and they use news to we're gonna flex our muscle as a big voice in the discourse here in America, and frankly, they should have been doing it through reporting much earlier. They should have been. There's been some really good media criticism about how one of the biggest failures of the American press since the WMD disaster was that the president of the United States, the most powerful man in the world, was mentally incapacitated, and we didn't know about it.
Correct. So that's a pretty good criticism, isn't it?
I think so. It's also something that you could demonstrate through reporting. So, you know, newspapers decide what to report on.
But let's go back to your first point, because they claim to separate their editorial position and their front page. That's their claim.
Yeah.
Okay?
Well, my parents told me that there was a tooth fairy. I mean, every newspaper has a certain distinction between outright opinion and news reporting. And yet there is always, as we discussed in our previous conversation, every newspaper has its bias. What you report and how you frame it and how much space you give it is where the bias comes through.
Correct. But I think the Wall Street Journal, which has a pretty conservative right-wing editorial board, has done a better job separating its editorial page and its news page.
And as a newsreader, is that what you like? There's still some papers, and the journalist chief among them, that are really playing the, like, this is the news from nowhere, objective journalism.
I bridle, and that's one of the reasons I read more than one newspaper. I bridle at the idea that some editor is trying to determine what I'm going to think about events.
Fair enough.
I think media have an obligation to do media criticism.
Who are you talking to?
And not just of the Rebel. I mean, why are there no media critics employed by Canadian newspapers?
All right. That I will agree with you on. Every 3 months on your Twitter feed, you say, we need media criticism in Canada, and it hurts my feelings every time.
No, I mean, well...
I'm right here, Norman. I'm right here.
I mean, well-funded, well-sourced, well-resourced, with huge bucks behind them. That's what I mean.
All right. Well resourced. The sourcing we got. But the funding, I'm with you. People should definitely support media criticism in Canada. That's our show for today. Thank you for joining me. You can email me about it at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything that you send. This episode is produced by James Nicholson with additional production by Sam Connert. Our production manager is Max Collins. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Smolam, new Chalkul.